And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but following God means having courage. What is courage exactly? Well, I'll tell you, in every dictionary, next to the word courage, we should see the name Phyllis Chesler, a leading feminist activist who has a message for other leading feminist activists and a message for all of us, actually. And I fear for the future of our society if people don't start listening to this inspiring woman who dares to raise her head and do more than repeat the conventional wisdom of the day, the politically correct wisdom of the day. I learned about Phyllis Chesler just recently and have already become one of her greatest admirers. You know, from the time we were all kids, almost every bedtime story we ever heard, almost every lesson taught by parents or teachers, almost every book we've read, almost every movie or television show we've watched has lifted up the virtue of courage. Now, I suppose there are varying definitions to courage, but let me tell you my definition. I define a courageous person as one who will stand up for what is right, even if they have to stand against the majority. This is especially significant when we remember that all too often in history, the majority has been in the wrong. The majority tends to get on board only when it's safe and without risk. For example, you won't find too many Americans who could justify slavery or racism today, at least not openly, at least not publicly. But the real heroes were those lone individuals who spoke out against such horrible institutions before it became fashionable to speak out against them. Today, I am honored to have as a guest on my program a true hero who is speaking out and taking a lot of flack from her peers for doing so. Her book, The Death of Feminism, is pure dynamite and igniting the kind of controversy that any real book should. That is, any book that truly has something to say. But even before this latest book, Phyllis Chesler authored other provocative works, including the 2.5 million copy bestseller, Women and Madness, as well as Letters to a Young Feminist and Women's Inhumanity to Women. She also wrote The New Anti-Semitism, a literary challenge that won her international acclaim and sparked huge debate. She is an emerita professor of psychology and women's studies, the co-author of the Association for Women in Psychology, the National Women's Health Network, the International Committee for Women of the Wall. She is currently on the board of Scholars for Peace in the Middle East, and the most courageous thing of all, she lives in New York City. Phyllis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, a thousand blessings upon you.
It's just wonderful to have you. Now, you grew up as an Orthodox Jew, and that's not usually what somebody thinks of when they think of a feminist. Tell us a little bit about your pilgrimage. I know you had almost an epiphany, not an epiphany from the sky, but a personal one, by taking a trip to Afghanistan in the early 60s. I read that in chapter 4 of your book, and it was just a harrowing experience. This should be required reading at every university. Tell us a little bit about your own pilgrimage here.
What happened is, since I was independent and rebellious from childhood on, I fled a very provincial Orthodox background in which women were not encouraged to study, as I now do study the Bible. And I had childhood, really a college sweetheart who I fell in love with, and we married, and he was from Afghanistan, and he was Muslim. And we went to visit his family, and I didn't have a plan to live there. And the minute I arrived, I entered the 10th century, and my American passport was confiscated, and I was told, oh, it's a formality, you'll get it back, and I never saw it again. Very, very typical.
Yes.
And
so you thought this was just a vacation, and it turned out he was bringing you there to live.
That's it. I call it my captivity, even though it was very posh. So I was put in purdah and meant to spend my days indoors socializing mainly with other women. And this is not what I had in mind. And I also then was shocked to discover that my father-in-law, who was a muckety-muck, he was, you know, a member of the 100 leading families of Afghanistan who lived in the 20th century. The rest of the country didn't. And he had three wives, my father-in-law, and 21 children. So I saw up close the way in which polygamy does not work, how it pits mainly the sons of each wife against the sons of the next wife for their inheritance and for their father's favor. And I saw how women who are stuck at home and are really prisoners in Purda, mistreated their female servants was the only safe way to sort of get out aggression and to do to others what was done to them. And then there's the much bigger picture of the no medical care, no education, no literacy, wage slavery, if not outright slavery. And the main thing is that it was normalized. I was the only one who was shocked by any of this.
And I know you mentioned in your book that you would occasionally talk to other women and even your husband about it. Tell our audience what kind of response you got. I know they looked at you like you were crazy, like
well,
you couldn't understand.
Well, they thought something was wrong with me to want to go out on my own, to not want to wear a sort of regulation head covering and long coat and gloves. And indeed, they had a point, because when I did make my escapes, which became daily, merely to adventure and see this beautiful and tragic country, I would get on a bus, and before Rosa Parks, there I saw women fully sheeted, wearing chadaris, head to toe, no peripheral vision, and they had to sit at the back of the bus, separate from the men who jeered them and jostled them. And these poor women, mainly who were poor, would be holding groceries and or a squalling infant. And I thought I couldn't imagine what I was looking at. And so I would say, I saw this terrible sight. And the response would be, well, you know, those are just poor women. It's not true. You have a Mercedes and a driver.
This was
happened to you.
Yeah, this was truly like getting into a time machine and going back 1,000 years in history.
I think so. Now the thing is that, and I nearly died there, and I did have to plot escapes. Now, when you have this kind of up close and it's not pretty experience, you have an opportunity to learn important lessons. So one of the lessons that I've learned, which stood me in good stead for the entire decade of the 60s, is not to romanticize third world countries and not to necessarily blame all barbarism, all barbaric customs, such as stoning women to death or amputating a limb or beheading somebody, not to blame barbaric customs on American empire or on Israel and its existence, or even on a European colonial history. And I also learned, I understood that the poor countries in the third world are, they may indeed have been victimized by colonialism in the past, but they are currently victimized by their own leaders who are greedy, corrupt, and barbaric. So I learned not to sign on blindly to a left position, reflexively blaming America for all ills and ailments, because I'd been there. I also learned a third thing, that if women's rights were not at the heart of an agenda for change, for regime change, that no democracy and no freedom is going to be possible.
Phyllis,
these three important lessons.
How long were you there before you realized that you were a prisoner? I know you talked as if it was kind of a gradual realization.
True, you're right. Well, in the first 10 days, I was trying to acclimate myself. I was living with my mother-in-law and my husband's eldest brother in a large home with some Western conveniences and gold marble, although they always cooked outdoors in the courtyard, even though they had a very modern, glamorous-looking kitchen. Nobody used it. And there were lots of servants. Maybe the first 7 to 10 days, I thought, all right, relatives are coming from the Hindu Kush, relatives are coming from Mazar Sharif, they're coming from Kandahar, these exotic names. And, you know, I'll sit and be bored and I'll meet them and we'll all smile and have a lot of pistachio nuts and things will be okay. After about 10 days, I was pretty impatient. And then my husband started to go into town with his brothers and or with his father to do family business. And I was left at home and told I really couldn't go out on my own and that there was nothing I should be doing except maybe getting clothes made. So this was incomprehensible to me. And something else began to happen. The husband, who was my friend here and with whom I discussed Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and De Sica, you know, Western films, became another person.
Yeah, that really seemed to come out reading the book. It was almost a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde experience, that the person he was in America is not the person he was when you got back to Afghanistan. Let's put a hold on that, Phyllis, because I'd like to get your insight on why you think your husband had these duplicitous characteristics. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Welcome back to our program. This is Bob Siegel and my very special guest. I'm so honored to have her, Phyllis Chesler, author of the book, The Death of Feminism. Phyllis, before we went to the break, you were telling us about your experience when you and your new husband thought you were taking a trip, just a vacation, back to his homeland of Afghanistan. He became a completely different person, and who he was as an American and who he was as a Muslim in his own country were different. How do you account for that?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word duplicitous. I would say that his circumstance was rather tragic, because in America, he really had a Western soul. And back in Afghanistan, he had to prove himself by shedding that Western soul and combining, you know, reuniting with his Eastern soul.
So you feel he genuinely leaned emotionally to the West, but he was kind of caught in a catch-22 when he went back home?
I'm just not certain. I think that many Muslims and third world people may have multiple cultural personalities. And I don't mean that as a psychiatric diagnosis. They are living in two worlds, and one of the lessons that we must, as Americans or as Westerners, learn from that now is that those who move among us who seem to be like us may actually not be. I'm not saying that they're all going to be jihadists or terrorists, but we have to be aware that things are not always as they appear. And people who speak our language, we had better learn what their language is, too. And so, for example, we now know that many Muslim leaders, many terrorist leaders, say one thing in English: we stand for peace, Islam is peaceful, we're in favor of peace, are saying in Arabic something entirely different. We stand for war, this is jihad, we have to seize Muslim holy lands, and the sky is the limit. So we have to learn to speak their language too, either to understand them and to protect and defend ourselves better, to broaden our horizons.
Okay.
So now, I wouldn't say duplicitous. I think that he...
It was a little more complicated than that. Duplicitous is oversimplifying it.
Yeah. But the thing is that he overnight treated me differently. He treated me suddenly the way men, all of whom have had arranged marriages, treated their wives, who are women who they look down on. And I had read more books than he. And I was writing, and he wasn't writing. And I thought, what is this behavior? It was day and night. And what's frightening is he didn't admit it, and nobody else but me thought anything was wrong with it because he was just fitting in.
Absolutely amazing. Now, when you realized that you were, for all intents and purposes, a prisoner, even though they weren't calling you that, you went to the American embassy for help. What happened then?
Well, the American embassy rented the embassy from my father-in-law.
Well, that was helpful. How helpful to your cause.
I have to go home. I have to get out of here. I don't want to be cooped up in the house. I need to go home. And I was very blunt. I was very clear. I was 20 years old. And I was told each time, well, where is your passport? They took it away from me. Well, without your passport, we really can't act on your behalf. You're now the wife of a foreign national.
Boy. Which
then taught me another lesson, that if you marry somebody in a Muslim country, if you're American or Western and a woman, you don't belong to any country anymore. You have no rights anywhere. So they would bring me, a Marine would escort me back home, which wasn't far away, and say, I'm sorry, that there's nothing we can do. So then and they were very polite. And some conversations with diplomats are also important because they had what I now, in the new book, call multicultural relativism. We can't interfere in these colorful local customs, in this barbaric custom, because if we do, then they'll be speaking Russian, not English.
Yeah.
And so I learned that not to intervene, not to interfere, not to feel morally obligated to try to help prisoners and those quite wretched in the earth is wrong, and that there's all kinds of complicated reasons for adopting such a policy. And then I began to plot escapes. I knew that I was on my own, and I had to figure out, how to get out.
Well, I'll tell you, most people wouldn't want to be trapped at their in-laws' house, even in America. For you to have been trapped there in Afghanistan is amazing. How did you finally get out?
I finally conjured up a plan with a German woman who was the wife of a former mayor of Kabul. And I had to call my parents, who, as you can imagine, were not thrilled that I had entered into this union and gone to that country, even on a visit. And I said that they had to send me an airplane ticket through this woman. And she was going to get me a passport in any name and from any country that she could. And I was going to board any flight I could get on. That was the plan. And then I passed out. I came down with hepatitis. And that particular season, I was the only Westerner who didn't die from hepatitis.
Man.
That was another experience because they treated illness very fatalistically.
When it rains, it pours, huh?
Well, you know, so many Westerners who've adventured to the East for all kinds of interesting reasons, maybe to shed ourselves of the kind of burden of individuality that we have here, or because we're attracted by the surrender to the so-called feminine or exoticized other, they come back with malaria. They come back dead in coffins. So this sort of adventuring, while compelling to some, is high risk. I mean, and Afghanistan, I was there before the hippies found it. And the hippies found it because of the opium there.
Oh, and the hippies would have just thought everything was bliss there. But
and the mountain ranges are quite gorgeous. And there are lovely, lush fields and flowers and melons and fruits. And it could have been very idyllic for a short visit.
Yeah, it looked like paradise, but there were certainly a lot of serpents there
at the same time. And also, by the way, there was anti-Jewish sentiment in the family, which totally shocked me. Because, again, the man that I knew was as sophisticated as I thought I was, and in terms of being tolerant. And now we know, and I write about it in the book, that Islam is the largest practitioner of both religious and gender apartheid in the world. So I was questioned about my Judaism, and my mother-in-law tried to convert me to Islam every day.
Was he your husband under any special disgraceful appearance because he had married a Jewish woman?
I think yes, and I think that it was partly that the marriage was not arranged, that he was not married to anyone whose family was important to them or in the country, and then to a Jew, and worse and funny, his brothers, who were very charming, and most of them really tried to cheer me up in the best way they could, said to me, you know, we can't understand it. And I said, what can't you understand? Well, we thought you would have blonde hair and blue eyes, and you could even pass for an Afghan woman. Why did he marry you?
So you didn't look like the prize trophy that they thought
he
set out to find.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay, well, you eventually got over your hepatitis and got out of the country. How?
Well, at the last minute, when some very dramatic events and much suffering had occurred, I went to see my father-in-law, who, it turns out, knew of my various attempts to escape and all my plans, and he said that he's decided that he's going to get me an Afghan passport, which he brought with him. He gave it to me, and I still have it. And he thinks it will be better for all concerned that everyone in the family see me off, and the reason that we'll all give to save face is that my illness, coupled with profound homesickness for my country and for my family, means I had to go home for a visit.
Well, considering the fact that he could have just taken care of you some more drastic and discreet way, this almost seemed like an intervention of God on your behalf.
You know, I wouldn't rule it out. I think he was glad to see me gone. I think that he didn't want a dead American daughter-in-law on his hands. I think that my health was fragile. I think that my husband did not want me to leave. And they were probably fighting something royal fierce battle must have been underway that I didn't know about. And then my husband didn't want to give me a divorce, because I immediately moved for that when I returned here. And I had to turn to an annulment instead, because he came here to fight the idea of a divorce, and he wanted me to return to Afghanistan. And I said to him rather prophetically, I said, you know, get out now. Don't stay there. I said, I know that you'll probably get some fabulous, you know, cabinet-level position, which he did in the country, doing just what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I said, trust me, it cannot last.
Well, Phyllis, you just have a fascinating story. We're going to continue with you after the break. My special guest, Phyllis Chesler, author of the book The Death of Feminism. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel with my special guest, Phyllis Chesler, author of the book, The Death of Feminism. Phyllis, I'd like to just read for our listening audience the first paragraph of your book, because, boy, you just can't put this thing down the minute you read the first word. It starts out, is feminism really dead? Well, yes and no. Doing so gives me no pleasure, but someone must finally tell the truth about how feminists have failed their own ideals and their mandate to think both clearly and morally. Only an insider can really do this, someone who cares deeply about feminist values and goals. I have been on the front lines for nearly 40 years, and I feel called upon to explain how many feminists, who should be the first among freedom and democracy-loving peoples, have instead become cowardly herd animals and grim totalitarian thinkers. This must be said, and my goal in saying so is a hopeful one. We live at a time when women can and must make a difference in the world. Boy, Phyllis, those are really fighting words.
Thank you very, very much. And I'll tell you that I recently, last week, testified in the Senate about Islamic gender apartheid.
Yeah. Now, how were you received there?
Well, now this is a briefing, and that means 9 senators sent their staff people, and 2 of the staff people also spoke. And this is a process, and I will be going back. It was the warmest of receptions. The place was packed, and it was filled with Iranian dissidents and Iranian feminists.
Oh, wow. Now, did you?
After I spoke, and the subject was both women's rights in Iran and in Iranian-controlled areas in Iraq. And I made it global. I talked about honor killings in North America, as well as the heinous atrocities in Iran proper, which is now going nuclear, as we all know.
Yes.
And one Iranian feminist said something so important. She said, finally, a feminist American leader who will not abandon us to her theories of cultural relativity.
Now, you're a pretty rare breed in that regard. I mean, there aren't too many other leading feminist leaders who are saying the kinds of things you're saying, are there?
There aren't, but let me tell you why, and this is so awful. First, so feminism, the established organizations have become just wholly owned subsidiaries of the Democratic Party, and therefore they're mainly invested in hating President Bush. And this blinds them to their own agenda in terms of women's rights, but also they are invested in 2 issues mainly. One is the right for women to have reproductive freedom, which means the right to abortion. And anyone who opposes that right is then designated as the demonized enemy. I don't see it this way, but most establishment feminists do. And certainly the battle has been a very hot one. And the second main feminist agenda item is sort of Me Too narcissism, whether it's gay rights and marriage. And by the way, I oppose, I don't oppose either of these. But for me, these are not the burning issues of the moment. And as I've said, even if we win a number of women's rights in America, which we should do, if we're all bombed back to the 7th century, what difference will it make? There's a war, and it's a very hot war that's been declared against us in the West.
Absolutely.
And that means women's rights is under siege as well. But it also means something else, that we as American-birthed feminists have a moral obligation to reach out, for example, to the women in Sudan who are being repeatedly gang raped, and they've already been genitally mutilated, and they're part of an ongoing genocide that no feminist established organization has done very much about.
But it's become so fashionable to hate America that to criticize a third world country just isn't politically correct anymore.
Correct. So that there have been many feminists who, for example, spoke much against the Taliban. But the minute America invaded Afghanistan looking for al-Qaeda, for bin Laden, and scattered the Taliban temporarily, the very same feminists said, well, with bitterness, we don't like Bush, We don't think he invaded for women's rights, and we're against war, all war. And so I would say something like, well, you know, we've learned about it's a crime to batter a woman and to batter her to death. And we, at a certain point, if we can't stop a man who's doing that, we call the police, right? And then the police come and stop him physically. That's what you do when you do military intervention. And they just look at me funny, like really funny. Or I have said when the Taliban were sort of ruling Afghanistan, I said, well, we have to then start sponsoring Afghan women for immigration, for political asylum. That means we have to put our hands in our pockets and start buying up their lives and then sponsoring them to become citizens here. And or I said, we can go in physically and bring them out. I said, these are the choices. I said, going on television and saying, oh, the Taliban is awful. Oh, we're so right because we're saying that the Taliban is awful. It's not enough. But I couldn't do anything on my own, and I couldn't get so many feminists to do much more than just that, and to also subsidize some symbolic groups that are appropriately secular and Marxist, who said that they would bring a Marxist and secular government to Afghanistan, which only made me laugh. I said, you know, with any luck, with all the luck in the world, if they get an Islamic constitution that gives women some rights, it's going to be a miracle.
Yeah. Now, Phyllis, would you say that when you're talking to other feminists that you've been observing that secretly deep inside a good many of them, more than we might even think, actually agree with you, but there's just this fear of speaking out, almost like the emperor's new clothes. Everybody knows the king isn't wearing any clothes, but nobody wants to say it.
I think you might be right, but I think that they also see that I've now been branded the worst. I have been slandered and branded the worst possible epithet, too, which is sort of funny. Rather than deal with what I'm writing about and in terms of the intolerance and rigidity of left feminism, which is as extremely fundamentalist as all the Islamic fundamentalists or the right-wing Christian fundamentalists that feminists oppose. They do not see their own fundamentalism and their own inflexibility, and I write about it in the book. So what I've been called, therefore, is A, the Christopher Hitchens of the feminist movement, which
I take
as a compliment. They don't mean it as a compliment.
Yeah.
And they have called me a racist and a neoconservative.
It seems like
they say I'm in bed with President Bush.
The word racist just seems to be a way to shut people up and take down any dialogue.
The thing is, you're totally right. It's very Orwellian because when you expose the atrocities against brown or black or olive-skinned peoples, both men and women, for example, under Saddam Hussein, or currently now in the Islamic Republic of Iran or Saudi Arabia, when you expose that, you then get called a racist, even though objectively you're talking about terrible things that are done to people of color by people of color, because what matters is who is the victimizer. If it's America or the demonizable Israel, then it's fine. Talk all you want. But if you are suggesting that a person of color is doing genocide, which Saddam Hussein did against the Kurds, doing genocide, then you really, there's no place in the boilerplate imagination of the feminist apparatchik to deal with it. You don't discuss it, or they literally psychologically disconnect.
It seems that our universities are not about dialogue anymore. They used to be a place to teach us how to think. And would you agree that the universities now are teaching us what to think, and that that might be one of the reasons why feminist groups in the universities are basically giving Islamofascism just a free pass?
Yes. But it's not just feminist groups. It's all student groups and most professors on campuses. And let's remember how much Wahhabi Saudi oil money has gone to fund so many Middle Eastern institutes, and how much George Soros and the Ford Foundation have funded the kind of people who are politically correct in this very specific kind of way, anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Jew, and so that rather than diversity, which they claim they want, and which they may really want, rather than diversity, there's a horrifying uniformity on campuses, and there are certain subjects that nobody brings reasoned or civilized discourse to.
And it's such a tragedy. They want diversity, but they certainly don't want diversity of opinion. Maybe diversity of people, but they want a monolithic opinion.
Of color, class, and perhaps sexual preference, but and gender, definitely above all. But they're not looking for diversity of opinions, diversity of ideologies, which is a crying shame. These are our universities.
Absolutely. Well, folks, hold on. We're going to take another break and get back to our very fascinating guest, Phyllis Chesler, author of The Death of Feminism. You are listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Welcome back to The Bob Siegel Show. I'm here with my very special guest, Phyllis Chesler, author of The Death of Feminism. You know, Phyllis, one of the things I like about you, I'm sure that if we talked long enough and got off of this subject, we might find some issues where we disagree. But I can tell that you're not somebody who would get all bent out of shape if somebody disagreed with you, that you could still carry on a respectful and civilized dialogue. But we're not seeing these dialogues much in our country anymore.
No, I, at the risk of sounding very old-fashioned, the absence of civility is everything. So I can respectfully disagree with someone who holds a different view, and I think it's important to model such behavior for humanity. And I think that I can also hear and not demonize someone who disagrees with me profoundly on a burning issue. And I've done it, and I think it's important for everyone to do this, especially intellectuals or media people and thinking people, educated people, ordinary people. Everyone has to do it. So if I disagree, now one of the things that occurred to me along the way in life is I began to study the Bible, and I'm the leader of a very important struggle in Jerusalem on behalf of Jewish women's religious rights. And so I, over time, began to understand that many of the progressive people, academics, including feminists, are fundamentalist secularists, and they have naught but high contempt for religion, for ritual, or for, and I'm looking at this and thinking, this is a shame, because very often, if you believe that humanity is not the last and only word, you are necessarily humbled, but then also strengthened in a fight against evil. And I think we are looking at both evil as well as ignorance, and religious communities and religious ideas can often strengthen us in that struggle in life.
So you see the Bible as something that empowers women, even though what we generally hear is that the Bible is a document that oppresses women.
Correct. So we are here, certainly the Old Testament, which I've been studying, and the New Testament as well. Which, I mean, years ago I had my students write the Gospel according to the Marys, so that there is so much room for imaginative interpretation, and there is so much room for wrestling with text that will nourish and console us in life.
Well, it's very interesting, because in the days when the Apostle Paul lived, the three chief distinctions in the Grecian-Roman world were the distinction between Jews and Gentiles, between slaves and masters, and between men and women. And in Galatians, Paul says in the church, there is neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave nor free. Those were about as egalitarian and liberating words as you could possibly get. Unfortunately, Paul said some other things that I think frequently get taken out of context. But people are unaware of some of the liberating verses in the New Testament and the Old Testament.
Well, you see, the Judaism and Christianity both have evolved. And now there is serious diversities and denominational differences within both of these religions. Islam has not evolved.
Yeah, there's been no reformation in Islam.
No reformation, no history of disagreement, fiery and respectful both. And there's been no change. And what's being envisioned, unfortunately, is a return to an even more primitive historical era when Islam and the state are one, and Islam rules the entire world, is the hope. I want to give an example of something that it's in the book, and it really just bothers me.
Sure.
When I talked about it. There's a feminist journalist who did a very good book, I thought, on women in the Arab world, looking at their suffering. And so I turned to it. The first thing I noted is up front, in her map of the Middle East, there is no Israel.
Oh, that's very
common. All the other countries know Israel. Yeah. I'm in for a bumpy ride. And then I saw that most of the countries she described, she showed us the suffering of women, the female genital mutilation, the veiling, the arranged marriages, the routine daughter and wife beating, which is totally normalized, the honor killings. And she ascribed all of these customs to misogyny. When she came to the country she called Palestine, she ascribed all similar female sufferings to the so-called Israeli occupation.
And yet Israel is the only country in the Middle East that doesn't have that kind of persecution of women.
Well, that's true. No, it's not a feminist paradise, but it certainly is head and shoulders far and away above most of the surrounding, all of the surrounding Muslim countries. And so then I read the book very carefully and discovered that she said that Muhammad, really the prophet, was a pretty good guy towards women, and the proof she gave is that he even married women, including Jewish women, to make peace with Jewish tribes.
He loved women. He had a lot of wives. That proves he loves women.
But serious. So then she names a woman, Safiya bint Huyay, who indeed Muhammad did marry after he forced her to convert to Islam, which took place after he beheaded her father and her husband and exterminated her entire Jewish tribe in somewhere in southern Arabia. So I thought, if this level of disinformation is what's passing for premium feminist journalism, God help us.
Absolutely. You said something in chapter 5 of your book on the subject of the way women are oppressed regarding the Islamic world. You said, unless we fight against its practices, women everywhere may increasingly be forced under the conditions of Islamic gender apartheid. Could you expound on that?
Yes. The problem that Europe is having, and it's now really increasingly known as Eurabia, the influx of immigrants from North Africa and from Muslim countries worldwide who had no ability or no intention to really assimilate and become French people or British people, but who really wanted to get on the welfare dole, get the social benefits. And I'm not saying that there's been no racism and no cultural tension. There's been a great deal of it in Europe. But these immigrant groups, when they come to Europe, and I write about this in Chapter 7, you have honor killings all over Europe, and you have honor killings in North America. You have female genital mutilation all over Europe, and it's in North America as well. You have arranged marriages and pressures and punishments to marry your first cousin so that he can come from Pakistan or from the Punjab or from Afghanistan or from Turkey into a Western country. And if a woman or a girl resists or protests, she might be killed by her family and not necessarily prosecuted by a multicultural, relativist, and tolerant European state. So if we do not, as our administration, if we don't take the battle to the enemy, so to speak, the enemy's here, and the battle will be fought here as well, or here only. And I'm really, so for example, let me give us an example of, there are so many that I write about in the book, but here's one, the first one that I focused on in North America that received a lot of attention at the time was a 16-year-old Palestinian girl named Tina Issa, who lived in St. Louis, Missouri, and her crime was she was becoming a little too American for her family to bear. And she also had a friend, not a lover. She had a friend who was an African-American schoolmate, a boy. And her family beat her up a lot. They threatened her a lot, and so much so that she went to school counselors for help, but they didn't get involved. She went to a social worker who didn't get involved. They figured it's a different culture. Well, then her mother and father, and this is typical, both stabbed her most brutally to death.
Oh, my goodness.
And
how horrible.
Wait, 1989, and the only reason that they actually got prosecuted and jailed is because her father was an Abu Nidal terrorist, and the FBI had been taping and wiretapping his home and phone.
Wow.
They had her murder on tape, And once things were sorted out and the jury got to hear how she died and who killed her, and three of her sisters believed she should die also, because they referred to her, anyone who, and this happens all over the West Bank, it happens all over the Middle East, any girl or woman who is wearing a skirt a little too short, or might put on lipstick, or says she wants to go to college, or says she might in the future want to marry for love, is already at risk. So this happened right here on our own soil, and were it not for the FBI wiretap, they would have gotten away with it. And there are many other honor murders in North America where, indeed, the perpetrators got away with it, and more in Europe, far more in Europe, because there's a very, very intense population, where we've seen the intifada that the world cheered when it was only unleashed against Jews in Israel.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to talk. I'd like to talk more about Europe specifically. In fact, you're listening to Phyllis Chesler on The Bob Siegel Show, author of The Death of Feminism. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Bob Siegel Show. My very special guest is Phyllis Chesler, author of the book The Death of Feminism. Well, Phyllis, the time went by too quickly for me. We're down to our last segment, and I'm going to ask you some more questions in a moment, but we'll probably be right in the middle of something when it's time to go. So let me ahead of time at this time thank you so much for honoring us with your presence today. You are absolutely fantastic. You are a wonderful person and a courageous person. It bothers me that you're getting the flack that you're getting, but it is so much to your credit that you're pressing forward despite this.
Thank you so very much.
Now, you were talking a little bit about the fact that in America and in Europe, we tend to overlook or grandfather clause what goes on in Muslim countries because it is another culture. There's something else that's interesting going on in Europe, and I know you wrote a book about anti-Semitism as well. It seems that for a while Europe regretted its anti-Semitic past, but now Europe is becoming increasingly more anti-Semitic. Synagogues are being burned down. Why do you suppose that is? Is it because of the Muslim influence? Is it that? And is there something else going on in Europe?
I think that Europeans are tired of feeling guilty or being made to feel guilty about their murderous role in the Holocaust. I think that Europeans have been Palestinianized both by their leading left public intellectuals, who American intellectuals copy, and they've been also increasingly brainwashed by Saudi Wahhabi oil money that is teaching them that two things, that Palestine is an occupied region, and the victims there are pure and noble and not murderous and treacherous suicide killers who've impoverished their own people, which is the case. They've been learning that it's okay to be open season on the Jews to scapegoat the Jewish state.
And it's horrible. There is so much historical revision about what went on. You know, that I bet most people on the campus, students and maybe even a good many of the professors, don't even know that the Palestinians were offered a state of their own in 1948. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the fact that there was already the state called Jordan, which was 75% of Israel sold behind Israel's back when the British mandate of the League of Nations had promised all of it to Israel, and yet they're still fighting over this little sliver that Israel still has.
Well, if you said what you just said on so many college campuses or in the corridors, you would, if you were a professor, you might be suspended, as a professor was at DePaul University in Chicago, and you might then be attacked as a racist, and your lectures would be stopped and invaded cold. If you tried to say this in a lecture, the brown shirt level of fascist-like, Gestapo-like tactics on American campuses would stop you right in your tracks.
They do, and I've been on a lot of college campuses, and what I've discovered, Phyllis, and maybe you can tell me if this is your observation too, it seems that after 9/11, post-9/11, the anti-Semitism grew, the support for Palestine grew.
Yes, but I began to track that in 2000 when the Intifada was unleashed by Arafat against Israel. And I call this the Palestinianization of the world imagination, and the United Nations is part of this process. And the Europeans, to go back to your earlier question, I think they felt that if they sacrificed the Jews of Israel and the Jewish state, that somehow their own Muslim population would leave them alone. And of course, they were wrong, because when you don't stop Hitler from invading Czechoslovakia, Hitler then starts bombing England. So the Intifada has, alas, gone global. The very Intifada 2000 against Israel, that's been against Israel since the inception of the Jewish state, has come to our shores on 9/11, and has certainly been attacking embassies and American embassies abroad for the last 10 to 15 years. So we are now all Israelis. We have, as citizens, as innocent citizens of planet Earth, we are all Israelis now.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your book, that when some Muslims use the word Israel, it's a code word for Europe and the United States in addition to Israel. They basically mean the non-Muslim world.
Correct. Israel is seen as the symbol of modernity, democracy, women's rights, freedom, freedom from despotism, tolerance, and true diversity. Under Islam, Christians are persecuted mercilessly. You can't become a citizen of, if you're Jewish, you cannot become a citizen in any Muslim country, and this is not called racism, you know, bizarrely. And if you are a Christian, you cannot build a new church. In Saudi Arabia, you can't hold an open church service, and Christians have been punished for holding private church services. In Indonesia, three young Christian teenage girls were beheaded merely because they were Christians.
And people just don't want to hear this. Do you think there's going to be any peace between Israel and Palestine unless Palestine can finally recognize Israel's right to exist?
Well, I think it's not just Palestine. I think it's Al-Qaeda. I think it's the Arab League. I think it's the United Nations. I think it's the entire...
The whole continent of Europe, practically.
Yes. It's all the countries that cheered on Arafat, that tyrant, that...
Oh, he was his group was, they were cutthroats, they were rapists, and they gave this guy the Nobel Prize. It just makes your head spin.
I think nobody should ever accept such a tarnished prize after he received it.
Oh, absolutely. If they gave it to him, who wants the thing?
Well, I guess many people do. They've continued to receive it.
Still looks good on the resume, but boy, the people that they're giving. In our last couple of minutes, Phyllis, you're so persuasive, and I know that you are an intellectual, but you talk in the language of the everyday person, which is, again, very much to your credit. Somebody's probably thinking, well, what can we do? Do you have any practical suggestions for bringing this message that there is a threat in radical Islam? Because it seems like that message isn't getting out nearly as much.
Well, everybody needs to start educating themselves about the nature of radical Islamism and know that we're really at war, and the war has been declared against us, and that those who died, may they rest in peace, on 9/11 were not guilty of anything. And 9/11 was not a Mossad or a CIA plot, which is the opinion in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, and among leftists, too.
Oh, like Ward Churchill, who teaches openly that they were mini Eichmanns.
Or Norman Finkelstein. And there are many. There are many intellectuals, and some of them are Jewish intellectuals, and some of them are Israeli intellectuals who demonize the Jewish state first. They hope that they will then be spared the ravage of the terrorist bomb. You know, the bomb will divert from its pathway toward them because they're politically correct. I think it's important for us to have a foreign policy that is pegged to women's rights and human rights in every country, and that means we should be doing trade or peace treaties with countries that will begin to recognize and elevate the status of women from subhuman to human. And I think we need to deal in a very serious way with a nuclear Iran, whose human rights atrocities are far even graver than Saddam Hussein's were.
Yeah, radical Islam and nuclear bombs don't make a good marriage. Phyllis, we've come to the end of our time. I know we barely scratched the surface. I hope you'll come back on our show again. You are always welcome here. You're absolutely wonderful.
I will definitely come back. You are equally as wonderful.
Oh, well, it's
everyone has to stand up to the big lies.
Well, thank you so much, Phyllis, and God bless you.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.